This is Ken Gullett with Family Resources. I'm speaking with Ann Rehm, founder of the Voices and Faces Project and keynote speaker at the 2012 Family Resources Honor the Women Luncheon coming up September 27th. Ann, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Tell us about the Voices and Faces Project. What are you accomplishing? And why did you start this?
Interestingly, the project itself started as a book. Myself and a really wonderful documentary photographer named Patricia Evans wanted to travel around North America and identify women and men who had lived through sexual violence and felt that if their story were treated with dignity and their story were used in service to awareness raising, they would be willing to come forward. And we originally looked at that as a book project for North America. And what was really amazing and deeply moving was as we started to embark on that journey, we continually had women and men saying, not only do I want to be in this book, but I would be on a website if you would build the website, or I will be a part of a speakers bureau if you need anyone else to speak, or my story could have implications for public policy. You know, would you be interested in or willing to have me speak on Capitol Hill or speak at my own state house in my own region? And so we really then stepped back and thought about what the Voices and Faces Project could potentially be beyond a book and realized that these stories had applications not only in the U.S. but beyond, A, B, that there was a multitude of women and men who had a hunger to share their stories. You know, one of the initial things some of my own mentors in the movement challenged me on when we first started this was, you know, how are you going to find people actually willing to come forward? And what's been extraordinary is we have more women and men willing to come forward than we sometimes have places for the stories. So we then really looked at the project and said, if we create as our primary responsibility creating a safe place for story sharing and then identifying different ways and places to connect those stories to the general public, to bring those stories to the attention of people who may not ordinarily see or hear stories like this, and that, of course, is going to be what I'm going to do at your luncheon, those stories can be incredibly compelling and can actually get people to think differently, not only about the issue of sexual violence, the damage that's done to victims, but also the potential when victims are given the support they deserve for them to rebuild their lives and become a very powerful force.
I was watching an interview that you did, and you used the term first responder in a way that I've never really thought about it before. I think of an ambulance driver or a paramedic, but you referred to a first responder also as someone who you first tell of your ordeal.
You know, I very much grounded that in my own experience and the experiences of so many women I've interviewed for this project and had the privilege of talking to. The number of people who tell me that the difference for them between going forward and continuing to talk and seek help and completely shutting down was that first response. And very often, because most of these crimes go unreported, you know, most women don't come forward and call the police or call 911. So very often the first person they tell their story to may be a family member or a close friend or their rabbi or their priest or whatever, you know, leader in their particular faith-based community. And when that first response is either negating of the trauma they've gone through or disbelieving or, you know, one of the heartbreaking early interviews I did with a woman named Tracy Stevens, she talked about, and she's a very devout Catholic, first going to her parish priest. And the first thing he said to her after she disclosed that she was a victim of rape was, you know, Tracy, your first job is to figure out how to forgive this person. And of course, what she really most needed to hear at that moment was, I am so sorry. What can I do to help you? How can I get you to the help you need? How can I be here for you? And that single response that she received really changed her relationship, not only to her church, but also her relationship to talking at all. Her sense that people would understand and that there was a safe place out there. And so what we try to talk a lot about on this project is the fact that any one of us at some point in our lives may be a first responder. You know, we may leave this luncheon next week, and as someone leaving the luncheon is talking about what they saw or the issue of sexual violence, they may have a friend or family member say, "I never told anyone this, but," or "this happened to my sister, and." And the way we respond, you know, whether we respond compassionately or thoughtfully, or we respond in a way that says, "You're making me uncomfortable, I don't want to talk about this," can be life-changing for someone. I don't think this is necessarily an issue that we can leave to the professionals. We can't just say, okay, for you to get support or help, you need to call 911, or you need to get to a rape crisis center, or you need to talk to a counselor. That is all very, very important. But we also need to recognize that our roles as compassionate listeners can be world-changing for someone. And there's something very scary about that, I think, for many of us, but also very beautiful, because it allows us to realize that we can be a force for change and for good. And that's a really huge gift.
Do you find that survivors want to talk, even if they haven't?
I think there is a hunger in almost all of us to be known and to be known for our real experiences. And when you've gone through something this painful and this traumatic, the desire to be heard seems to be extraordinarily deep. And I even, as I think I said earlier to you, I even felt that when we started this project, you know, when I had people saying, you know, "You're going to be lucky if you can find 10 people who will come forward and share their names and faces and stories." And now we have well over 300. And I think the world is surprised. The world wants to think that survivors are remaining silent because they're afraid or because they're ashamed. And surely sometimes all of us may feel those things. All of us who have lived through sexual violence, and I'm a survivor of sexual violence myself, so I know I've had those feelings. But I think the hunger to speak is greater than any instinct towards silence. And I think that when we as a culture, you know, when we in our own communities acknowledge that this is an issue and create spaces for people to come forward, whether it's a rape crisis center or a family services center or a faith-based community, I think you see exactly what you're talking about, a powerful desire for survivors to speak in the survivor community.
What are the things they have to do most to go from being a victim to a survivor?
That's also a great question, because I don't see those terms as mutually exclusive, and I'm probably somewhat unique in the rape crisis community in that I think that we can be over the course of our own lifetimes both. You know, that I will always be someone who was a victim of violence, but I am also someone who survived that and have gone on to reclaim my life and to fall back in love with my life. And I think that has happened for so many of the women and men I've interviewed.
I think you just used an interesting term, though, was a victim.
Victimhood is not a state of mind, right? So I will always have the identity as someone who has been a victim of violence. You're right. It's in a certain sense a past literal moment, but the reality of sexual violence is such that you sometimes live with the ramifications of that in complex ways over the course of your lifetime. And so I think the interesting broader question that I ask myself as I interview survivors, that, and I try to ask them because I'm very interested in learning from them, is exactly what you're saying. How do you get there from here? What is it that allows people to effectively rebuild their lives and to become women and men who have been shaped by the violence that's done to them? Because I don't know in my experience that I've ever met or interviewed a survivor who was not in some way shaped by that experience with violence. But at the same time, they become greater than what has been done to them. And what I've seen repeatedly is that we don't do that alone. We do that when we have support. We do that when we have a family services agency or a rape crisis center to turn to. Sometimes we do that because we have the privilege of having health care and access to the mental health or physical health services that are so critical. And so our project's been very interesting in that we are a nonpartisan organization of people working on these issues from the right and the left. And I think one of the most fascinating things to see is that for some people who have thought that survivors can do it on their own, there's been a reawakened sense on our project of the importance of the social services safety net. And for some on the project who perhaps felt all the solutions needed to come from government, there's been a renewed sense of the importance of community, whether it's faith-based community or other forms of family and community. But the overarching theme in all that is that when someone has lived through sexual violence, they need us. They need us institutionally. They need us individually. They're going to have a host of needs that they themselves are not even going to be prepared for. And that seems to be, when I look at women and men who have effectively rebuilt their lives in the wake of sexual violence, someone or some institution stepped up and was there for them. I have yet, with all my interviews, to interview a single person that I look at and say, wow, you really did that all on your own. Now, it takes a huge amount of personal and individual courage to even seek out those resources or to begin, you know, what is sort of the slog of rebuilding your life when you're in great emotional pain and you've gone through something very traumatic. But, you know, the services that you all provide and the services that the rape crisis centers and family service centers across the country, I have such a privilege in meeting so many people doing this work. And I always want to start when I talk to them by thanking them, because in some ways I'm here today because of what was then my local rape crisis center and my crisis center in Washington, D.C., the D.C. Rape Crisis Center. You know, I imagine that sometime around the time that I've lived through sexual violence, some organization threw a luncheon and said, you know, would you help? And those donations indirectly ended up changing my life.
What is the most important thing you could tell someone who listens to this and has been suffering in silence? What's the most important thing they need to know to get their lives moving again?
Such a great question. I think the first thing to know is that you can. We really started this project because I remember the first year after I had lived through sexual violence and I was working at a very male-dominated lobbying and communications firm in Washington, D.C., and I would go to work every day, you know, once I went back to work, and look at the different women in the room and think, I just wish I knew that one of you had gone through this, just so I could know that I can get through it too. And one of the extraordinary things that I think social media, and I hope projects like the Voices and Faces Project have done, is they allow us to look at stories of women like us who have gone on to rebuild their lives, or men who have gone on to rebuild their lives. Marion Wright Ellman, who's the founder of the Children's Defense Fund, who's been such an extraordinary role model for me, and I know many other women, has this wonderful saying, if you can't see it, you can't be it. And what I hope someone who has gone through this, who is wondering if they can get through it, I hope they're able to do is to see and find the stories like the stories in our project. See through those stories what is possible in the wake of what is terrible. And I think the second thing I would say, I know you asked for one, but I'll give you two.
That's okay.
The second thing I feel very strongly about is find a safe place to talk. You know, when I first lived through this, and I think for a lot of the women on our project, by the way, who are most vocal, who are out there speaking all over the country, some of those women spent years having only talked to a handful of trusted people, whether it was someone at their rape crisis center, a clergy member, a close friend, a partner or spouse, and that was enough for them. And maybe that's going to be enough for someone listening to this for the rest of their life. But I'm quite convinced that we need to talk about it somewhere. And the beautiful thing for folks in your particular community is, of course, you have a somewhere to go. And one of the most heartbreaking things when I'm in communities where people don't have easy access to a rape crisis center often is realizing that it's not so easy to get to that someone.
We're hearing more about trafficking, even in communities such as the Quad Cities.
Right.
What does this mean and how prevalent is it? I think most of us hear that in the past and think of drugs, not people.
It's a great, really important question, and actually a big piece of what the Voices and Faces Project is working on right now is a campaign called End Demand Illinois, which is looking at domestic sex trafficking and prostitution and sexual exploitation, and coming to understand how women are trafficked, how often they are trafficked in the United States or lured into prostitution, and the links between sexual and domestic violence and sexual exploitation and trafficking are great, meaning that I've interviewed and met many young women who have either entered into prostitution or been trafficked. And one of the universal themes often is that they left home, in some cases have left their homes because of physical or sexual violence, end up as runaways on the street, and are very quickly pulled into the system because they have nowhere to go, nowhere to sleep, and someone convinces them that they can be a dancer or a model or, you know, I'll be your boyfriend and take care of you. And I think one of the most significant human rights challenges of our time in the U.S. right now, internationally, but there is also a slightly greater recognition that sex trafficking is an international issue. But we need to start recognizing that sex trafficking and sexual exploitation occur in the U.S. And in fact, there is not an insignificant issue in stats regarding sex trafficking in, as you noted, Iowa. And in fact, I think one of your major papers did a quite extraordinary series on sex trafficking in Iowa a couple of years ago. And so I think our position with the End Demand Illinois campaign, and I encourage the folks listening to this to check that out. You know, if they Google End Demand Illinois, you're going to see a host of resources. And in fact, the Voices and Faces Project is working right now with support from the Novo Foundation to create an anti-sex trafficking public awareness campaign that's going to be launching in early 2013. And one of the first things we have to start doing is having conversations in our own communities, acknowledging that this happens and acknowledging that women who are trafficked are victims. Because very often when I'm talking about the issue of sexual exploitation or women working in prostitution, I'll hear someone say, well, that's really a victimless crime, or that's a choice. And when you have listened to the stories of these women, you are very clear it is not a choice. And I think we also need to be very clear that we won't end sex trafficking until we end demand. And the demand exists in our communities. And this has been one of the most painful things for me to wrestle with. You know, looking at the sheer numbers when you look at sex trafficking and prostitution, you have to come to acknowledge that probably someone we know, probably someone I like very much, has accessed those services. So it's not other men or other people doing it. It's people we know. And unless we start to have a public conversation about that and talk about the real damage done to women and girls through trafficking and prostitution, it won't change.
Your website is voicesandfaces.org.
I'm going to give you two websites. Voicesandfaces.org is our organization's website. And we have a second website called counterquo.org, C-O-U-N-T-E-R. QUO.org. And that's a joint website that's run by the Voices and Faces Project and the Victim Rights Law Center. And it explores some really important questions about the intersection of media, representations of survivors, law, you know, how we can really start to change a culture that allows sexual violence to occur. And the third website I'd send you to that explores the issues of sexual exploitation and trafficking is our partner organization, the Chicago Alliance Against Sexual Exploitation. And it's not just Chicago specific. It's really a broader exploration of sexual violence, exploitation, and trafficking. And that's CASE, CAASE.org.
What's next for you in the project? You mentioned earlier that public policy still needs to be impacted. What are the most important things that need to be done from a public policy perspective?
Well, the absolute number one priority right now is the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. And in fact, if your listeners can visit endsexualviolence.org, they're going to see an overview of why the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act is so critical. And it is right now stalled in Congress. And hopefully after the election, we're going to be able to break through there. But the Violence Against Women Act has really made the rape crisis and domestic violence shelter service network that, as we know it, possible. It is one of the most important civil rights acts of the last 50 years, frankly. And so it's up for reauthorization a decade after it was passed. And its reauthorization is absolutely critical. And so that's something that survivors from our project are sharing their stories in hopes of making that happen. A second really critical policy that we're focused on is anti-sexual exploitation law and really creating laws with Illinois as a blueprint that end the demand for sexually exploited or trafficked women and girls in our own region. And so that is also a priority for us.
How do you end the demand?
I think you end the demand in two ways. One is that you hold men who buy sex accountable in different ways. One of the saddest things that I hear over and over again when I've interviewed women who are sexually exploited or trafficked is that very often when they're arrested, they're put in jail and the man they are with is sent back to the suburbs with a slap on the wrist. Now, there's something fundamentally so unjust and so wrong about that. And I think one of the things we need to do, instead of incarcerating women and girls who very often are working in the sex trade because they don't have education, social services, because they were runaways who fled abusive situations, is to create programs that actually allow them to get back on their feet and allow them to build a life. And if we can take a look at, you know, a different system in Illinois, we're looking at is how to hold men accountable in a way that may include fines and sentences that would actually allow us to funnel resources back into social services for the women and girls who are trafficked. That's a legal way to address it. I also think there's a really important cultural way to address it, meaning that it's absolutely critical. You know, when I talk about women who are sexually exploited, whether they're working in prostitution or they've been trafficked domestically or internationally to a large group, I'm usually aware that there's probably someone in that group. There are men in that group who may be a part of the problem and not the solution. And I think one of the most important things we can do is share the stories of what these women and girls are going through or what they may have gone through that led them into working or being exploited by the sex trade. And I've seen and heard men say, when I really started to think and understand and know more about what these women and girls had gone through, I didn't look at it anymore as that's just the world's oldest profession, or, you know what, that's just a choice. That's just their choice. And I had a harder time after that justifying paying for sex. And that's how change occurs. That's the power of a story. And my hope with the Voices and Faces Project and with our work we're doing on both sexual violence and sexual trafficking is that the power of the stories we're sharing, the stories are transformative for the women and men sharing them, but more importantly, they can transform the culture. They can get people to think differently about sexual violence or sexual exploitation or sexual trafficking and get us to look at our own communities and systems and say, I want to be a part of the change, not the problem.
It's very important work. It's really fascinating. I could probably ask you questions for 2 hours.
Well, I'll be there next week, so we can do that.
All right. Anne Rehm, founder of the Voices and Faces Project, thank you very much, and we are all looking forward to meeting you on the 27th.
Thank you so much, and I will see you next week.
All right. Thank you, Anne.
Take care.
Bye-bye.